daughter. Take one. I need to be famous, Wayne. All the best people are.
There ain't nobody else out there like you.
You know why?
Why?
Because you got that X factor.
Our days of struggling may soon be over.
Hollywood, here we go.
So this is it. Our own studio backlot.
You're looking for a place to stay?
Oh, yes, sir.
That's one ugly son of a bitch.
And my wife, Pearl, is next door, so I would appreciate a little discretion.
He don't know what we're doing, does he?
Well, it's better to beg for forgiveness and ask for permission.
Would you like to come inside?
My surprise.
I want to be in the movie.
Well, you can't.
The story can't just change midway through.
If Daddy catches us, there's no telling what he might do.
My wife is not well. It happens after dark.
People's eyes are gonna pop out of their damn skulls when they see this.
What? Are you all right?
No.
Boys found this inside.
What do you think is on it?
I see one goddamn fucked up horror picture.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the newly relaunched Warehouse Podcast. I'm coming to you pre-recorded and edited from sunny Culver City, California, the original home of Hollywood. I'm your friendly neighborhood podcaster, Aaron Escobar, that time with an E. I know it's been quite some time since we've posted a new episode, but like most things that get left behind by the wayside, life after COVID simply got in the way, both for the better and for worse. After such a long hiatus, we just had to return to what we love doing the most, talking about cinema and the films that inspire, thrill, shock, and awe us. It's in my blood, soul, and heart to discuss and analyze cinema from all around the world and from all decades and all genres. Honestly, I have been in love with cinema since I was a wee lass, as they say. And frankly, I cannot imagine doing anything else with my life other than just devoting it entirely to an art form that by all means is now mature. It is a century old. It, you know, first really launched in the late 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, Lumiere brothers, with The Black Mariah by Thomas Edison in New Jersey. It started out from such simple, humble origins and is now a multi-billion dollar a year industry that spans the globe. Every country, every continent on this planet has some form of cinema, has some well-known actor or actress or director or writer. So thank you for taking a listen to my ramblings. I've missed these little audio essays, these fireside chats, if you will. And it's a pleasure and a privilege to be allowed to openly discuss and converse about the films that inspire me and keep inspiring me. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. In honor of Spooky Month, the best time of the year, let's be honest, I figured we could kick it off with one of the best horror films to date, Ty West's new classic, X, from 2022, released by everyone's favorite indie distributor company known as A24, who's been kind of riding high since their Oscar win with Everything Everywhere All at Once this year. So if you have not seen this film, I need to give you, you know, just obvious spoiler warning. If you have not seen it, highly recommend that you go out and watch it before listening to this episode. Pause it, go watch it on Amazon Prime or HBO Max, come back, and then listen to the episode. Starring Mia Goth in a dual role as Maxine and Pearl, Jenna Ortega as Lorraine Day, Brittany Snow as Bobby Lynn Parker, Scott Mescudi as Jackson Hole, which I just kind of love the ridiculousness of that name. Martin Henderson as Wayne Gilroy, Owen Campbell as RJ Nichols, Stephen as Howard, Simon Prast as the televangelist that we later find out has a special connection with Maxine, James Galvin as Sheriff Dentler, who has probably one of the best lines in that film, one goddamn fucked up horror picture. It's just so cheesy. It's so indicative of what this film is trying to be a reference to. Obviously, you know, grindhouse slasher films of the 1970s and 80s. And everyone just sort of plays it as it is. Everyone knows kind of the film that they were crafting, that they were shooting, that they were trying to create. And it shows in every minute of this film is just a complete homage and love letter to the films of the 1970s and 80s, specifically grindhouse cinema and slasher films. Think of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Faster Pussycat Kill, Kill, things of that nature. We'll obviously dive further into that in the warehouse on the podcast. But yeah, so there's film is just, it's, there's a love letter to it. There's an emphasis on the era in which it's set and that era of filmmaking that I absolutely admire and love and respect. Themes and influences. Nate Roskor of Fangoria wrote in an essay on the film that X exemplifies a modern take on the psycho body horror subgenre in which aging or elderly women portray grotesque, violent caricatures. Roscoe also notes that the film's primary theme revolves around aging, youth, and longing over the past, snatching its inspiration from the shadiest recesses of art and exploitation. It is the relationship between beauty, aging, and self-worth that creeps most conspicuously through the architecture of X's two acts and main actresses, obviously being Mia Goth as Pearl and Maxine. Both played, obviously, again, by Mia Goth in a wonderful performance that I think was highly overlooked. I think casting an actress, especially as young as Mia Goth, relatively speaking, to play an elderly geriatric in her 90s, juxtaposed to her playing, you know, this very young, very sultry sort of temptress girl in her 20s, was a brilliant move on Ty West's part. Because it really does solidify and deliver that contrast of fleeting youth. You know, that saying that youth is wasted on the young. This film is very much taking that to heart, using Mia Goth in both the Pearl, who obviously has a prequel later on, and Maxine. They're more or less the same character, just at different phases in their life, which I find incredibly fascinating. He also notes that the film presents its antagonist, the murderous Pearl, in a manner that is sympathetic, writing that at moments one can't help but feel crushingly sorry for this tragic figure. Critics noted the influence of several films on X, with multiple commenters observing homages to the 1974 film The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Other films cited by critics as having an influence on X include Psycho, 1960, Hardcore, 1979, The Shining, and Alligator, both from 1980, and Boogie Nights, 1997, specifically in its reference to sort of the porn subgenre and, you know, the art and creativity and the inspiration and the influence that goes into making pornography. Because let's be real, a lot of porn is artistic. There's that fine line between voyeurism and pornography, and sometimes there is no line at all. Sometimes that line is entirely fictitious and made up in our heads, and I think X, along with Boogie Nights, kind of points out that there really is no dividing line between smut and, you know, snuff films being kind of a thing, kind of films marketed as snuff films, I should say, because we all know what actual snuff films are, and supposedly there has never been a real snuff film. But the point being is that pornography and filmography are more or less the same thing, because, you know, if you talk to people that work or that are sex workers that do porn films, they're inspired by regular cinema. They want to make something meaningful. They want to make something beautiful. They want to elevate their craft to something more than what it should be or what it could be or what it is perceived as. And, you know, there is something admirable in that, I think. And I kind of do agree in that review that Boogie Nights and X do share similar themes in sort of their love and homage to the pornography films specifically of the 70s and 80s. Like Boogie Nights is very specifically late 70s to mid 80s, and obviously entirely different film, but there is that homage to that era of, you know, when porn started moving away from the theaters and started entering our households on VHS tape and Betamax, and then obviously DVD, and now it's just proliferated everywhere, including online and on our phones. So these two films do very specifically focus on that era of pornography. Richard Roper wrote that X also contains echoes of such pornographic films as Blue Movie from 1969 and Debbie Does Dallas from 1978, neither of which I have seen. So if you want to like check X Hamster or X Videos or whatever, feel free to do a search on those. I have not seen them. I cannot say if it takes inspiration from that. There is a joke about Debbie Does Dallas. So there is that reference going for it. I'm not an aficionado when it comes to like vintage snuff or vintage smut. I'm sorry. I always get those two confused. But hey, if you are, feel free to watch them and let us know in the comments if it's an accurate description of X or not. X. Yes, you have to say the title like a movie announcer from the 1970s. Mostly because the film itself, with its plot themes, raunchy and satirical sex scenes, and open and candid conversations about the validity of pornography as an art form, even going so far as to state, very bluntly and very broadly, that it is possible to make a good, dirty movie. One of my favorite line deliveries in that movie is literally that 5 seconds, because it's possible to make a good, dirty movie. And it's just, it's so accurate of, I think, how it's a commentary of how we misunderstand pornography, but also how the people that make pornography make it with honest intentions. It's like, obviously, they make it to make a buck like everything else, but they also try to put their heart and soul into it just as much as anyone else does. Makes the film one of the most recent additions to the grindhouse horror aesthetic of the mid to late 1970s, and the on again and off again retrospective critiques modern cinema has had with that genre. Notable examples of this retrospective grindhouse cinema include films like Planet Terror, Death Proof, Hobo with a Shotgun, Machete, and its sequel Machete Kills, just to name a few. These are just a handful of modern-day examples of the still young but growing subgenre within horror, which I have kind of taken to call postmodern retrospective grindhouse. Yes, that is a very, very long mouthful, but in short, you know, if you were to distill it down, postmodern retrospective is grindhouse cinema that is self-aware that it is grindhouse cinema and plays into those tropes satirically to sort of rise a laugh out of the audience rather than invoke shock or awe or horror or suspense. It's essentially grindhouse cinema defanged. It's grindhouse cinema done as a way to sort of deliver a punchline and a joke. Think of sort of like Tucker and Dale versus Evil as kind of an inverse on the slasher genre, kind of like the rednecks in that film are not the bad guys. It's the kids that are the bad guys that sort of mistakenly through a series of MacGuffins and just, you know, a series of unfortunate events, mistake the rednecks for being the bad guys. And to an extent, I would say modern grindhouse cinema with the aforementioned Planet Terror, Death Proof, Hobo with a Shotgun, those were films that played to the grindhouse aesthetic for laughs. You know, I don't think a lot of people got scared of Planet Terror, nor do I think a lot of people got scared of Death Proof. I'm fairly positive a lot of people were shocked and probably inspired by X, mostly because it is more of an earnest attempt at recreating grindhouse cinema as it was in the 70s. So yes, I know postmodern retrospective grindhouse cinema is a mouthful, but in essence, I think that's a fair description of it. And I would consider X to be anti-retrospective grindhouse cinema. There is a fine level of self-awareness that it does have, but it isn't self-aware in the fact that it's making fun of itself for being a grindhouse film. That I think is an entirely meta perspective that X doesn't necessarily touch upon. It has meta commentaries for other aspects of mass media and filmmaking, but it doesn't necessarily have a meta commentary on the grindhouse genre as a whole. It is more playing to an honest attempt at recreating what a grindhouse film was like from 1979, if that makes sense. However, while the above mentioned titles use the look and feel of grindhouse cinema, going as far as visibly degrading the film stock to achieve a worn out and used appearance, complete with noise lines, cigarette burns, and even sometimes like VHS fuzzy like lines or real missing segments to simulate the experience of attending a B-movie double feature from modern audiences, X serves as the counterweight to the bombastic, over-the-top, raunchy for the sake of raunchiness approach found in most current-day examples of grindhouse cinema. Again, it is playing to those tropes in an honest attempt to recreate those tropes. Free of any sort of convoluted story plot, free of any sort of meta-commentary on grindhouse cinema, which I think is very niche, if we're going to be honest, because not a lot of audiences would catch on to grindhouse cinema. Grindhouse is a very niche appeal, and mostly it's just film fanatics, you know, it's cinephiles like us that would understand the aesthetics of grindhouse cinema. So I appreciate X for a lot more for what it's trying to do, and that is, it's not trying to deconstruct grindhouse cinema for laughs, it's just trying to play into those tropes to actually invoke a true sense of horror and shock. And I actually come out appreciating this film for that reason more than I would say Planet Terror or Death Proof. Instead, X is a film that reveres and admires the independent spirit of the genre's iconic filmmakers such as Roger Corman, Russ Meyer, Herschel Gordon Lewis, Lucio Fulci, I always mispronounce his name, I cannot speak Italian, and of course, everyone's king of zombies, George A. Romero, who probably did the most famous grindhouse film of all time, Night of the Living Dead. You know, you can essentially classify Night of the Living Dead as a grindhouse film because it was a grindhouse film. It toured the country and played in little tiny tents and carnival towns just because it could not get mainline distribution for the longest time. It serves as a both meta-commentary on grindhouse cinema and its filmmakers rather than a retrospective of the more elaborate aspects of the genre. In X, you won't find massive car crashes or strippers with a shotgun leg. Instead, what you are given is both a commentary on the exploitative nature of the genre, with lines of dialogue nearly mocking the rule of thumb, as in, audiences aren't here for the plot, they're here to see tits and ass and a big dick. On the surface, X could be called a generic slasher film, almost deliberately so. The plot can be summed up simply as, in 1979, a group of young filmmakers set out to make an adult film in rural Texas. But when the reclusive elderly hosts catch them in the act, their cast finds themselves fighting for their lives. Of course, its setting in rural Texas plays directly to the homage of, you know, probably perhaps grindhouse cinema's greatest cultural contribution, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 1979. And one of my personal favorite films by Wes Craven, The Last House on the Left, from 1972, which does predate, you know, A Texas Chainsaw Massacre by 2 years, but it is in itself a grindhouse film and set, I think, in rural Idaho or Montana. Rural Wisconsin, because I think that's where Wes Craven was a professor at, if I remember correctly, or I could be wrong. If someone remembers where Wes Craven was a film professor, please let me know in the comments, because I don't remember from the top of my head. But I would say X is sort of within that lineage of, you know, Sleepaway Camp or, you know, Seven Little Indians. You know, you go into the forest and you don't come out. It plays into that trope and those beats of that kind of slasher film, deliberately so, because that's the point it's trying to make. It isn't really trying to be all that groundbreaking in terms of story, in terms of themes, in terms of genre, in terms of, you know, slasher tropes. It's playing into them in a sort of reverence, admiration, homage type of way. And it's not bombastic about it. It's not over the top about it. You know, some of the most horrific parts in X are someone getting impaled with a pitchfork, or someone getting a nail driven through their leg, or, you know, someone getting bludgeoned to death. Those are the most grotesque parts of X. It isn't really over the top. She loses a leg and has a shotgun attached to it and, you know, goes around kicking ass. That is not this film. That is it's avoiding the mockery of Grindhouse, I would say. Its structure closely follows the beats of any respectable slasher film. The group gets separated one at a time and picked off in increasingly horrific ways, from being impaled by a pitchfork, eaten live by a crocodile, blown away with a shotgun, or bludgeoned to death by a 90-year-old woman. However, what sets it apart from any other film of the same nature is a contemplative look at the horrors of aging and the struggles of reclaiming lost youth after a lifetime of broken dreams and promises. And of course, the nightmarish elderly sex scene. Seriously, that's actually one of the worst parts of the film. And it's not even grotesque in the sense that it's, you know, it's not... The geriatric sex scene isn't graphic. It is just very disturbing because of the way it's situated and set and shot and edited together, with the sound editing and the music playing and Mia Goth's performance as both Pearl and Maxine, who's hiding under the bed while this elderly couple is having sex on top of it, which is probably the most like invoking of a very horrific childhood trauma I'm sure most of us are probably willing to forget, like, you know, walking in on your parents having sex or something. Like, it is evocative of that kind of childish nightmare when you see something that you know you probably shouldn't have gazed into, but you did. And it's that sort of lacking of understanding of how to process what you just saw. I would say it is horrific in that sense. Yet in any other context, that would actually be considered a deeply romantic moment as an elderly couple tries to reclaim their lost youth in their final days. In any other film, that moment would probably be considered romantic and thoughtful and sweet, but not in this movie. In this movie, it is utterly horrific. It is utterly terrifying, and it is absolutely disturbing. Again, it's invoking that sort of childhood fear of witnessing the adults do something that you probably shouldn't have watched. It's kind of like that little, you know, corner of the eye, what the fuck did I just view in The Shining, when you're running through the Overlook Hotel and you see a dude and a guy in a bear costume, probably the first example of furries in modern cinema. And you're just like, what was that about? Okay. And it sort of follows within that footsteps of you get a quick glimpse of something kind of otherworldly, that because you're not really used to seeing geriatric sex scenes in movies. And you're just like left sort of with your jaw on the floor, just like, what the fuck did I just see? But then you realize in any other context, that would have actually been a very sweet and intimate scene, an elderly couple trying to rekindle their lost love, but not in this film, which is something entirely different, I would say. And again, what you also won't find in more modern versions of this type of film is an amazing dual performance by Mia Goth, who takes on both the roles of Maxine, a young coke-addicted stripper turned porn star with what she describes as cosmopolitan tastes and a belief that she's a fucking star, contrasted against her role as the elderly Pearl, reclusive and broken old woman who was once a dancer with dreams of stardom in her youth as well. Her life up until this point has been confined to living on her dilapidated farm with her husband Howard, which we find out later in its prequel Pearl that this has been the case since at least 1918, adding a layer of bitter tragedy to Mia's performance in X. We witness the transformation from the bright youthful Pearl in Pearl to an old and bitterly elderly woman facing the end of her life in X. In some aspects, this provides context for her murderous rage towards characters who, in the most ironic of ways, serve as dark reflections of Pearl in her youth, the woman with dreams and aspirations of fame on the silver screen, obsessed with early 20th century cinema and the emerging art of stag films, now referred to as porn. Pearl, in the darkest sense, is a twisted reflection of the same dreams and aspirations that Maxine possesses. This is contrasted by the bitter reality for Pearl, as Maxine is able to live the liberated existence she only dreamed of, while Maxine is free and open about her sexuality, even going so far as to openly skinny dip in their lake. Pearl endured abuse and mistreatment from her extremely conservative, controlling German immigrant mother, essentially robbed of her dreams by the cultural constraints of the early 20th century. And I do, again, wholeheartedly believe that casting Mia Goth in this dual role as Maxine and Pearl, and, you know, obviously we're getting the third film in this X trilogy called Maxine, which is supposedly set in 1985 Los Angeles, with, I guess, Maxine sort of being a rising porn star. And yeah, you don't need to sell me any more than that. I am already going to go watch that film. I once pre-orders for those tickets open up, I will be the first one in line opening weekend, because that sounds fucking amazing. But I do agree that casting an actress, especially one as talented as Mia Goth, in a dual performance where it's essentially the same character from different ends of the spectrum at different points in their life. One, obviously, at the start of her life, with all her dreams and aspirations still on the table for her. She can do anything she wants. She is sexually liberated. She is enjoying the sort of fruits of the feminist labor that would later come on in 19, because, you know, if you think about Pearl's situation, 1918, women didn't even have the right to vote yet, still didn't have the right to own land, still didn't have the right to have a bank account. So Maxine is enjoying the benefits of essentially what Pearl's generation created, whereas Pearl, an ex, is an elderly woman in her 90s who was essentially robbed of her youth because she never had a chance to really be young and embrace her sexual liberation and embrace her liberation as a woman, that was essentially robbed from her by the constraints of the 20th century. However, what seems to be an enduring fascination for me regarding X is its meta commentary on films and filmmaking. It goes even deeper by subtly critiquing the epidemic of parasocial interaction, which is sadly all too common in our media-obsessed lives. Toxic fans, celebrity stalkers, TikTok, Twitch, Instagram, Twitter, and more are all examples of this sort of parasocial behavior that we're all guilty of and developing. And to be fair, the term parasocial interaction was introduced in the 1950s by the social scientists Donald Harton and R. Richard Wohl during the early days of home television. They observed people developing a sort of intimate sense and understanding and relationship with actors who were really virtually appearing on their home screens. Think of Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, right? Or Rod Serling, or, you know, William Shatner, or the cast of Star Trek. We all sort of develop this. It could either be healthy or unhealthy. It really just depends on the person. We develop this sort of kinship and obsession over people that we don't know outside of TV, that we now don't know outside of YouTube or social media. So it's by no means a new concept, parasocial relationship. It's becoming a more apparent issue with our interconnectivity. We don't actually know the artists and filmmakers that inspire us, but we feel a kinship and, in the worst case, an ownership over them. I have a deep fascination and love and admiration for Greta Gerwig because she comes from a similar environment that I do in Central California, but I by no means know Greta Gerwig as a person. But I feel like I know her as a person because I've seen her films and I've been following her work for the better part of a decade. But that does not mean by any means or any stretch of the imagination do I know Greta Gerwig. That does not mean just because I, you know, enjoy the performance of Mia Goth in Pearl and X doesn't mean I know Mia Goth. I know the performances they do. I know the characters they play. I know the films they help craft, but I do not know them as a person, right? You know my voice on this podcast. You're probably hearing my cats meow in the background, but you do not know me as an individual, as a creator, as a creative person, as a person out on the street getting a coffee every day, right? You would not necessarily know if we would get along in person. That is not a guarantee. Another really good example that is sort of a critique on parasocial relationships would be Misery by Stephen King. It's a great critique on toxic and obsessed fandoms, which I think, to be honest, a lot of fans should watch. And to be frank, a lot of people should watch X going in with the concept of parasocial relationships and dynamics. That sort of goes hand in hand with my personal belief that we lack media literacy in the world, and it's not really something that is taught in our education system, how to read into films, how to understand cinema, how to understand media, and how we consume media. None of that is really taught. And I do think parasocial relationships and lack of media literacy and awareness are fundamental issues that we really need to focus on. And I do think that is where a lot of our sort of incel culture comes from, is that lack of knowledge and is that parasocial relationship, because people cannot draw a dividing line. It's muddled. Again, we don't know our creators. We don't know our actors. We don't really know our filmmakers. We don't really know who's behind the screen. And I do think that is something we're all guilty of. So, you know, it is continuing that parasocial dynamic. Both Maxine and Pearl are guilty of such behavior. And in turn, they have shaped their goals and aspirations around the notion of being a fucking star, as Maxine quotes. I cannot do a Texan accent. I am technically part Tijuana because my dad was born in Del Rio, but I do not have a Texan accent. Pearl, with her dreams and hopes of being a dancer to escape her small life on the farm, even names her pets after classic Hollywood icons like Charlie Chaplin and Theda Bara. Subtract Pearl's murderous outburst, and what we are left with is a dark reflection of us, the audience. We are the Maxines and Pearls of the world, styling ourselves after icons and celebrities. This is even more the case for those directly working in media. What inspired me to work in media was consuming films, was media. And I shaped my life, my career goals, my interests, dreams, aspirations around cinema. In more ways than I can count, I am Maxine. I am Pearl. And you, dear listener, are Maxine or Pearl. Our lives have been modeled and shaped by films itself. We are the dark reflections of X, media-obsessed monsters willing to do anything for fame. Perfectly summed up by Jenna Ortega's character, who joins in on the porno shoot instead of just recording it. She decides to be more than a passive observer. She willingly chooses to become an active participant, going so far as to remove the cross from her neck in a basically symbolic way of rejecting the modernity, rejecting the morality given to us by religion, if that makes sense. I think one of my favorite sort of brief moments in that build up to Jenna Ortega's performance, which is also just incredible as well. She feels like she would have been a final girl in this film if it wasn't for being overshadowed by Mia Goth. But what I loved about Jenna Ortega's character is it sort of leads into this dynamic that, you know, a lot of people are willing to talk the talk about art and creating art and creating something meaningful out of an art form that most people would sort of consider lowbrow, you know, in it being porn, and pointing out the fact that in a lot of ways, if you're not necessarily forced to do sex work, it can be liberating. It can be, you know, free. It can inspire in so many ways than we can possibly imagine. I think one of my favorite lines in that sequence is, you know, ain't none of them nice girls, in reference that Jenna Ortega's character isn't a porn star. She's just a regular woman, a regular, you know, young 23-year-old girl. And you have the more experienced characters who are like, well, see, you're putting a label on someone, and by putting that label on someone, you're robbing them of their own agency. You're robbing them of their own desires and willpower and their own sexuality. And in a lot of ways, I actually don't take offense at the term ain't none of them nice girls, because I actually think there is sort of a pride to have in being a whore, if that makes sense. There should be sort of a dignity in reclaiming slut. You know, we've done that with bitch, I would say. And we sort of happily embrace, you know, the term bitch. Oh, that bitch, or I am that bitch. Or if you want me to be a bitch, that kind of thing, right? Like, we've for the most part, reclaimed the term bitch. We have yet to really reclaim the terms slut or whore. And I don't really think those are insults, you know, because what society deems to be slutty or whorey or trashy is always constantly changing, and it's more of a headache to keep up with what's changing and what society deems to be prudish or what deems to be whorish. And so you might as well just be you. And if being you means people consider you a whore, then embrace the term whore, because there's nothing you can do to not have someone call you that. And I actually really do admire the film for subtly kind of hinting that to some extent, if a woman wants to be liberated, if she wants to be free from the constraints of modern society, of religion, of your past, or your family, or your family's moral compass, and try to develop your own sense of morality, you do have to embrace the whore. And there is nothing wrong with that. And I do think there should be a push to reclaim that term, and there should be a push to be proud about someone calling you a whore rather than being insulted by it. I don't think it is insulting. That's just me. I could be wrong in my interpretation of that, but I do really appreciate Ty, or even probably Mia, for interjecting that moment that, you know, in order to be liberated, in order to be free, in order to bask in the sexual liberation of the 1970s and 80s, you do have to embrace the whoreness. You have no choice, because someone somewhere is going to call you a whore, and there's just no denying it. And what is the difference between porn and art, really? The simplest answer is that there is none. We all trade parts of ourselves for the hopes and dreams of stardom, whether it's our bodies, minds, emotions, or skills. The true monsters of X aren't the vengeful, bitter, elderly couple beaten down by a life of failed dreams and broken promises. It's the obsessions that shaped those dreams and desires in the first place. Obsessions that still live on in the likes of Maxine and persist even to this day in me, in you, and countless others. Again, what got me into film was watching other films. I have shaped my entire existence, my entire life, around cinema, around media, around pop culture. Is that a way to live? Is that an existence? That's up to you, dear listener. Sorry, if you're hearing like a little tiny pitter patters, my cat Luna is having like a mental breakdown and just running around the house. I try to record as quietly as I can, but these two bitches just ruin it all the time. But again, I do think the commentary is very, very subtly pointed at the audience. Very few of us, you know, ever reach that level of stardom, but we all aim for it. A vast majority, I think, would aim for it. And a vast majority of us end up as broken, bittered old individuals lying on the ground, blood spattered and beaten with a broken hip, screaming at the next generation that their dreams and aspirations will be taken away from them, just as it happened to us. Or perhaps you're Maxine, doing a line of coke, the final girl driving off into a dark future, willing to do even more unspeakable things to other people and to herself to become a star, because none of us can accept a life we do not deserve. I think what truly makes this film memorable is, you know, if you read it on a surface level, it is just a slasher film. It is just a slasher film through and through. There is really nothing deeper to analyze about it if you were to just read it on a surface level. It's a slasher film that's an homage to grindhouse cinema of the 1970s that is loosely inspired by films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Last House on the Left, and Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, right? That is one interpretation of reading this film. Another interpretation of reading this film would be, it's a critique on parasocial relationships in our media-obsessed culture, on how we base ourselves and our worth in our level of stardom, right? There's star meters on IMDb. They don't mean a damn thing, and they fluctuate every day. I kind of check my star meter. I don't know why I do. No one cares about me, but I check it anyways, right? I read the trades. I read the dailies. I read The Hollywood Reporter. I read Deadline. I read Variety. I work in media. So my life, my daily working life, is consumed by media. Is that any way to live? Is that a way to build an existence? Is that a way to build a personality and a desire for a future? Is that a way to become a whole person? If I'm just an amalgamation of personality traits of other characters, then am I really a human being? Or am I just a weird Frankenstein mashup of mass media? Maxine and Pearl don't really have personalities outside of just the media they consume. Pearl, in her youth, watches, you know, silent era films and, you know, starts watching the talkies around the turn of the 20th century and watches newsreels and, you know, bases her life off of what she sees on the silver screen, because that was her first window into another world, that there was a life outside her farm, right? That was the same case with me. My first window into another world was cinema. My first glimpse at a life outside my tiny little chicken farm in the middle of Central California was other movies. Was, you know, the Sundance Channel, was IFC. That's how I watched Korean cinema before it really became popular. That's how I watched grindhouse cinema. That was my first foray into film school, was, you know, channels like HBO and IFC and Sundance and Showtime, things like that. And we all have different versions of that story, especially if you work in media. We all have different tells, but they all lead to sort of the same takeaway. It inspired us, and we decided to choose a life in that field. It takes a kind of a stupid person to willingly do that, because it is not a successful industry, as we can clearly tell coming out of the strike. But X is a critique on that, that we all, to some extent, build our personalities and our hopes and dreams and aspirations off the concept of fame and fortune and stardom, right? And I think it was Andy Warhol that said, in the future, everyone's going to get 15 minutes of fame. And with our sort of social media obsessed generations, because it's more than just millennials, let's be honest, it's, you know, it's Gen Z, it's Gen Alpha, it's even a little bit of Gen X. We all want that sort of 15 minutes. And people have done and continue to do horrific, horrific things to not only themselves, but to other people to achieve an iota of fame. And Pearl and Maxine are basically that. They will do anything to achieve an iota of fame. And the takeaway that you sort of have at the end of this film is, was it worth it? You know, I love sort of the haunting, melancholic ending of Maxine and Pearl being the same person, but one is fractured and one is broken, both figuratively and literally. And the other one still has all the promise of youth ahead of her, but also a very, very, you know, you find out at the end of her film that the televangelist that has sort of, you know, pops up throughout the course of the movie is her father. And her quote, "I don't accept a life I do not deserve," is sort of her twisting her father's religious philosophy to fit, you know, what most people would consider a sinful life, working, you know, I don't consider it a sinful life, because I'm going to be honest, I have had an OnlyFans. I have been with a sex worker who's a partner of mine, and they do it very respectfully. They do it thoughtfully, and they're very mature about it. So I don't consider it a sinful life, but there are still facets of our society that do. And the takeaway from this film is, I don't really consider those to be two different things. You could say, you know, selling your body is a sin, but at the same time, right, we all sell our bodies. We sell our minds, we sell our labor, we sell our work. I sell mine to a different facet of the industry that is just as horrific, just as evil, just as malicious as anything else in this world is. Clearly so, coming out of the strike, right? And I think what sort of sticks with me about this film, as Maxine drives away doing a line of coke off of her thumb, with Wee Marie playing very hauntingly in the background, you know she's headed off into a dark future, and she might make it, but she's going to have to do very horrific things to other people, just as Pearl did, to, you know, maybe get a little bit further ahead in life than Pearl ever did. But she's still going to have to resort to violent and horrific acts. And she seems to be very willing to do that, the same that Pearl was. Pearl was very willing to kill people if they, you know, crossed her. And the takeaway with Maxine is, Maxine would very well do the same thing as Pearl did if someone crossed her. And especially if you work in cinema, especially if you are a media-obsessed person, the sort of takeaway from that is, what are the horrific acts you're willing to do in order to reach stardom? And I think that's a lingering question that I do not have an answer for. And whatever that answer is going to be, I really hope it's better than what Pearl and Maxine offered. But so concludes our first episode of the newly relaunched Warehouse podcast. Our goal is to at least do 2 or 3 episodes a month. hopefully we can live up to that. I think one of the key problems with the first round of the podcast was that it just became a little too strenuous to keep up with the release schedule. So I'm trying to do a release schedule that is within reasonable metrics that I can meet every week or every 2 weeks on top of my other workly duties as a development coordinator. So stay tuned for next episode, another in-depth retrospective of another A24 film that helped me come to terms with my grief and the loss of my father and best friend and grandma between 2021 and 2022. And that is another A24 film, this time by Ari Aster, 2019's Midsommar, with probably one of the best actresses working to date, the beautiful and lovely Florence Pugh. But until then, dear listener, be safe and take care of yourself. Enjoy a nice hot cup of coffee or tea, read a good book, watch a good movie, play a video game, make some art, just watch films, I suppose. This has been your host, Aaron Escobar, signing off. Hey.